Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Teager and I'm joined today by, well, by no one actually. I'm currently recording this by myself in the studio. Ian, my normal co-chair for these podcasts, is away in Huntington Beach at the Future Proof Conference, as are various other members of our team going out there, getting all the scoops that we write about on the website and subsequently talk about on this podcast. But don't worry, it's not just me filling time this week. We have, in fact, prepared an episode for you. It's an episode that Ian and I recorded a few weeks ago, back in sort of late August, I think August 26th, and it's an interview with Eric Amar. So for those of you not familiar with Eric, he's currently the founder and CEO of a firm called Accelerated Wealth Partners. But before that, he was at a long tenure at Focus Financial Partners, where he was most recently its chief growth officer. He spent more than a decade there, and he oversaw somewhere around 60 transactions of wealth advisors. So very much the focus of this interview is mergers and acquisitions and sort of how one values an RAA, what sellers should be looking to do and thinking about before selling a firm, the main considerations buyers should be thinking about, how the trend has evolved, how the market's changed, and where things are going next. It's a fascinating interview, if I do say so myself, so well worth a listen. And without much further ado, I'm going to wrap up what's been a slightly lonely and sad introduction and cut straight in to the interview with Ian and I and Eric.
So you worked when you were at Focus around, I believe there was north of 70 transactions as the lead negotiator. So
quick point on that, your website still says 60, so you should update that.
60 that I'm willing to discuss, 70, 10 okay. of them we'll try to not discuss any longer.
So how did the negotiation process change as Focus grew and matured and this industry professionalized and matured?
Yeah, it's been an interesting evolution. Obviously, we started Focus back in 06, where life was easy because there was virtually no competition and the value prop was very powerful, I think, in our world. Today, the place is very crowded. It's very crowded by people who are not quite sure what they're building, but they know they have to buy a whole bunch of stuff, right? Which changes not just the negotiation, but the amount of time people have to think about their options. When you get 5 phone calls a week from 5 different buyers, you get overwhelmed, right? You want to find the right fit. You want to find the right home. And on the buyer side, you just hired a team. You just took a bunch of capital infusion and you just have to do these deals. You have to do these transactions. And, in the spreadsheet of some very smart person on Park Avenue, it says you have to do 10 deals a year. And so you're going to have to do 10 deals a year. And it changes the conversation from a long lasting dating period of what is the right fit? What business are we trying to build together? How do we think about your role, my role? How do we work together as a team? How do we make this company better, not just bigger, to what is your number? And that leads to awkward outcomes. And I think down the line, it leads to companies that we're not quite sure what they're building.
It's really interesting. And I think that chimes with, we've only had one other guest on the podcast before, as you referenced, Peter Maloof. And I think he made the same point. Now, look, obviously, Peter's building a business and buying firms, and we'll come on to it in a little bit, but sort of so are you to some degree at Accelerated Wealth Partners too. So you have, let's say, something of an agenda to say some people are doing this badly, and the implication is, we're doing it well. But it does seem that this is potentially a rife issue, that there's too many people trying to buy businesses and they don't know what they're going to do with them. What's the worst sort of possible outcome in that case? How long does it take before you realize you've sort of just smashed a bunch of things together?
No, fair enough.
And what actually happens when you do?
What happens is unclear, right? I mean, when people ask me what can go wrong when you're looking at investing into an RIA or wealth management firm, the only way to break those businesses is bad deals, right? Because organically, these businesses never break. The clients stay, the advisors are happy, right? It works for the entire ecosystem of stakeholders. And Peter is obviously an extreme example because he's built the most scalable, the most successful business in this industry by a wide margin, I would argue. Everybody else is on the spectrum of trying to figure it out. So far, nobody got hurt, right? Now we have some firms that have tried to transact that haven't quite transacted because investors looked at it and said, well, I'm not sure what this is. This is a bunch of stuff cobbled together. Obviously, Focus as a public company, we suffered from that quite a bit because our model was by intent, very decentralized. And we got penalized for that. And now obviously the new strategy is to go the other way. So I think we haven't seen the backlash of it just yet. What we've seen is obviously multiples have gone up. And so the arbitrage for the ultimate owners of these businesses is changing a little bit. The math is changing a little bit. But more importantly, inside of these businesses, you see things that don't really fit together, right? Oh, we bought a corporate VC. We bought a charity, like an institutional consultant, and we have a mass affluent business, and we have a cross-border business. And you're like, so those can be capabilities within one entity, but they're not that. They're just things shoved together and all sitting on Orion. And it's hard to call that a business at some point. So we haven't quite seen the backlash. What we believe is that when these businesses are smaller, it's obviously much easier, right? Because it's stronger leadership, stronger culture, and advisors tend to be attracted to businesses that are consistent, that are, they can have a seat at the table. There's a clear vision. There's a clear solution to client's problem. And that tends to work really well. If advisors still work at your firm because of the non-compete you have on them, because they took some equity along the way, that's tough to sustain down the line. And by the way, we know what this looks like. This is what Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch have been for 20 years, right? They're still very successful firms. They're incredible businesses. Some of my friends work there. Some of my friends are clients of these firms. They're very happy, but there's attrition every year. So if you build these ginormous businesses that are just Frankenstein of other things, so far the worst case scenario we've seen is you don't transact or you don't transact very well and some level of advisor attrition, which is not the end of the world if you reach massive scale.
But there's a better there's a better situation that's available.
Yeah, I mean, listen, those are, if you think about it, you're building consumer businesses. And so I see it, I would argue, almost as a barbell, which is either you do it the Peter way, which is, and I don't want to say that in a negative way, this is meant to be a compliment, the McDonald's of wealth management, which is, it's a consistent—
it's the headline, clip it up.
It's a consistent value proposition across the board where your Big Mac is going to be the same in Chicago, New York, or DC. And it's going to be, you know, high quality, highly scalable. And if you show up to an office with $5 million, you get the same client experience, which is great, very comfortable. A separate sales team, strong brand, right? And then a service team with a lot of services, right? That's kind of one way to do it. That's if you want the panacea of what you want to build, if you build a not relying on people wealth management business.
Okay, yeah.
Right? Because any one of these advisors leaves and it doesn't really matter. People are here for the brand, for the company, which is what makes it so special. Or you go arguably very small, which is, this is my local Hartford advisory shop where my advisors will take care of me and they'll do a great job and they'll over-service my business, which from an investor perspective is not great, but from a client's perspective is amazing. And from an advisor's perspective is amazing. And listen, I'm a client of an RIA, probably the only person doing what I do, which is in the RIA kind of investment business, that actually is a client of an RIA. And I would challenge you to ask people you talk to if they're clients of RIAs. Most of them are not.
Do you invest in the RIA that you're a client of?
It's actually, yeah, it's one of the Focus firms, yeah, which is a very special firm. I think their culture, their people, it's a firm called Crestwood Advisors. Let me plug them a little bit. And they're one of the most exceptional firm in the industry. Have they done 1,000 deals? No, they have not, right? They grew from 1 billion to 8 billion over the span of 8 years. They've done 3 deals, fairly small, but they've built a very, very successful firm. And so I'm one of their clients.
Do all the Focus directors. And, does the previous Focus board all invest with them?
No. Okay. A few of my coworkers used to. As a client of this firm, my advisors spend a lot of time solving problems that are adjacent to my personal financial life, whether it's my family, my extended family, whatever it is, which is not great business practice, but from the perspective of my household, they over-delivered, right? That's the traditional RIA business that is a practitioner's business, that is an over-servicing business, which is what makes it that the clients never leave. And so either you have the super high scale, super readable, super repeatable consumer finance business that Peter is building, or you have the traditional high touch, high stickiness advisory shop. If you're in the middle where you're trying to get scale, but you don't know how to do it, and you lower your level of service because someone is telling you, get rid of your small clients, right? We saw Fisher change the minimum. We saw someone saying, ooh, put all the small clients into a bucket where they're going to get just lower services. All these things change the DNA of an RIA and moves them towards something else, which I think creates issues down the line.
Ian, I'm really sorry, because you have a brilliant list of questions and I dived in with one and massively took us off tangent. So did you want to kind of return to focus here for a moment? The focus of the interview, not the company.
No, but like, given all of those dynamics that you've described, I mean, what are the traits that you select for when you're looking at a firm that might be an investment candidate or an acquisition candidate? So what are the traits of these highly effective firms that you want to see?
Yeah, I think it depends who you are, right? Obviously, if you're a big private equity firm that has to have a wealth management asset, they want to see something that looks, the best way I describe them is on the scale from zero to Peter Malouk, how close are you, right? If you have a firm that looks like Creative and that's 10 times smaller, you invest in that all day long. If you have a hodgepodge of stuff that built through M&A, that's a little tougher. So you want to find someone that has a repeatable system, that is a scalable system, that has high quality advisors. And that's if you're a big private equity firm that has to write a $300 million check, right? We're trying to do something a little different at Accelerated, where we're really trying to find firms that are smaller in the kind of call it $1 to $10 billion range, that are not trying to have an exit, that are more trying to say, okay, we're going to build a regional business where the culture is strong, the value prop is strong, and we're going to scale it by adding talent, by adding capabilities, by adding kind of institutional level organic growth, and we're going to have a better platform down the line, right? Because if you have a firm that is 20 billion, that is, I would say, a consistent business, I think that works really well. Or firms that are going to be the next category killer. We are the best firm for pick a niche, right? I don't want to say the niche of the one we're talking to right now, but, you know, think of, let's say, law firms, right? We are the best firm for lawyers. If you're a lawyer and if you work at a big law firm, we understand your pension plan, we understand your work hours, we understand your taxation, we understand your entire life. We can build that at scale. So those are the type of firms that we're looking at that we think can be very scalable and very successful. And just keeping it simple. These are not meant to be complicated businesses. When people are trying to over-engineer what these businesses are, I get very scared. This is not meant to be complicated. This is a very simple advisory relationship. We're going to bring clients. We're going to do a great job for these clients. And that's basically it. Everything else is just noise and people trying to justify their existence.
I mean, so you've been kind of on, you've been in countless negotiations. So what are, just from both, you know, from a seller POV and a buyer POV, I mean, what are the hard questions that you think people should be asking during negotiations, whether it's to ensure alignment, to make sure that there's not going to be clauses in the employment agreements that are going to prove onerous down the line. So if I'm a seller or a buyer, what should I be asking to avoid a nightmare scenario?
Yeah, if you're a seller, I think you just have to be aware of what you're getting yourself into more than anything else. And it's very easy to lie to yourself about what the answer will be. Oh, they promised me I'd have a big role there. Or they promised me nothing would change. I mean, I've seen people telling me I'm getting bought by mega RIA, pick a name. I don't want to tell you the name, but like I'm talking about an over $100 billion RIA, and they told me nothing would change. And I was like, you're fooling yourself. That's absolutely not going to be the case. And if that's the case, that's actually really bad, right? So obviously not. So you have to be very self-aware and very honest with yourself about things that are going to change, about what's going to happen to your employees. I think over time, the clients are pretty well served in this industry. So I know we have to care about the clients, obviously, that's very important, but it's not going to be a big change eventually to their experience. For your employees, it's a massive change. Right, because maybe half of them don't have a job anymore. Maybe half of them don't have a career path anymore. Maybe half of them now have sales goals. They never had sales goals and different things. So the culture will be very different. So to me, that's the number one thing as a seller, to really understand what that means. And then, which gets a bit more dicey, is are you able to leave at some point? Right, because, hey, I'm going to get a bunch of money. I'm happy to have a five-year non-compete. But then do I have a rolling something, then I have a five-year non-compete plus a two-year after I leave or three-year after I leave, that becomes pretty onerous. And then more importantly is the new non-solicitation clause are not really non-solicitation. They're really non-service clause, which is even if the client chooses to follow you wherever you go, they're not allowed to come to you. You're not allowed to take them on, which from a regulatory perspective, it's a little weird that a client is not able to choose what advisors they go to. So those are the new norms in the industry where the covenants have become very, very strong. What I find ironic is all the firms that have these very strong covenants pride themselves on having amazing culture and how everybody's so happy there. I would challenge them a little bit. If you're so happy, if your advisors are so happy, then waive all the covenants.
Yes. Yeah.
And the prisoners are so happy. That's why we have 30-foot walls on our prison and on guards, right? But they're so happy to be here. Well, let's find out, right? So let's challenge that hypothesis a little bit. And maybe at some point, someone will have the courage to do it and say, if you guys want to leave, that's fine. Because either I have full confidence that I will retain the clients because they hear from me, not for you, Mr. Advisor. Or I know that you're well paid, you're happy to be here, and that works really well, right? The answer is that in 2025, I don't believe people are rushing to go work at very large companies across the board, right? Across the entire country and the entire world, arguably. And so if your company is too big, corporate culture becomes an impediment to retention. People don't leave Morgan Stanley or Merrill Lynch because they're not well paid or because they're not taken care of or because they don't have enough capabilities. They leave because of corporate culture. And so are you going to have some of that at the large RIA scale? For sure. So from a seller's perspective, I would say, understand what kind of covenants you're signing up for, because nobody will tell you and you will have to get very deep onto that. And number two, just be very self-aware of, okay, what is my job in the next 3 years? I used to have a team taking care of them, deciding how they're going to get paid, deciding how to do for my clients, looking at investments. And now I'm going to be in this environment where I'm not really in charge anymore.
I imagine that's particularly, we've talked about this before, I think, on the podcast and in articles too, but particularly challenging for a lot of these firm founders who are sort of fundamentally quite entrepreneurial, who we all know the sort of the genus of the RIA movement, as it were leaving the Morgans and the Merrills of this world to do it by yourself, whether that was entirely because, whether that was a culture thing, whether it was a potential earnings thing, whatever the reason was, there was definitely a sort of an autonomy to it, which is lost in if you sell and join a big thing, depending on what you join.
You're just back around.
Yeah.
It's really a full circle environment. And now the ecosystem in the wealth management industry is built in such a way that it's actually very easy to set up your own shop today. I mean, you call Osaic, you call anybody and say, like, hey, I want to set up my own firm. I have 120 million and you're on your way the next day, right? Either as a 1099 or as an RIA using their platform, it's very easy to do. So you have to have a really good reason why you want to handle that environment. And so I think that's a challenge. So to answer your other question, about on the buyer side, the buyer's due diligence in this industry is pretty easy. We underwrite those businesses with just basically one number, which is, what are your net flows, right? Do you have fairly positive net flows? Meaning, are your clients staying, which is the departure number? Are your clients young or old, which is a net from existing? If your clients are adding money every year, they tend to be younger. If they take money out every year, they tend to be older. And then can you bring more clients in, which is the sales number. That's kind of the number one metric with three submetrics, obviously, of the health of that business. As a buyer, the number one error that buyers make in this industry is that they overbuy. Meaning, Ian, you used to make $5.5 million a year as the owner of your RIA. Congratulations, you're a very successful entrepreneur. And now I'm going to buy your firm. And now you're telling me, you know what, Eric, just pay me $100,000 a year. I don't need to make that much. Right? So now I'm giving you a big multiple on an artificially inflated EBITDA. And 3 years later, you have a bunch of money in your bank account. And do you really go to work for $100,000 a year? Do you really care? Probably not. Especially if you took all cash and you now work in a big corporate infrastructure where you report for the, you know, head of the East Coast direct, the director of the East Coast region of the whatever region of that random place. Like, why do I need to put myself through that? That's not fun. That's not what I wanted to do. So go back to the earlier point of understand your covenants, right? Now, if you said, hey, I'm going to join a place where I'm $1 billion and they're $2 billion or $3 billion, it's a different story. And we did a lot of that at Focus, where we would win transactions on the merger side, on the tuck-in side, by saying, billion-dollar firm in Providence joined Crestwood, at the time was $5 or $6 billion. And he chose Crestwood because they were a better fit culturally, a better fit geographically, and he became the fifth managing partner of the firm. And that played really, really well. And I think when you have a big story and you have a powerful story from a cultural perspective, from a seat at the table perspective, from an equity perspective, you will win deals. Another way of saying that is, if you are $3 to $10 billion RIA anywhere in the world, I would argue that every advisor or every smaller shop in a 100-mile radius would rather work with you than work for, again, I don't want to name names, but you get my point.
And you mentioned earlier, I think while we were recording, although it might have been before we started, that's where the real juice is, listeners. But you have to, well, maybe we'll set up some sort of Patreon account where you can hear the pre-record. But you mentioned earlier that you can have, you know, a PE firm that's just got a number in front of them, an X number of deals have to be made per year for this sort of plan to work. So as a result of that dynamic and that pressure on them, I mean, I guess ultimately, are they doing all the things that you've just said? Are they asking all the right questions when they buy? Or is it just like, look, come a certain point in the year, we need to go out and find three $1 billion RIAs that we can sort of make this happen?
You know, I mean, private equity is positive in the industry. I think net, it's been more positive than negative because it creates more professionalization, right? This industry was massively undermanaged. It's now arguably there's a start of slightly better management. To answer your question, sometimes yes, sometimes no. I would argue it depends on the private equity firm and depends on the underlying RIA and what their ambitions are, right? But if the firm has great organic growth, it becomes less relevant, right? You don't have to rush. If you grow organically at 15-20% a year, then you know what? The math still works. You can be more selective. You can be more thoughtful. If that's not the case, you have to be aggressive. And we see things that are very odd. I mean, I meet firms where, met a great firm recently, great niche, good team. They're about $3 billion, and they just took a bunch of private equity money from a very smart private equity firm. And the number two there tells me, oh yeah, we need to do, you know, our goal is to do one deal every 6 weeks.
Wow.
And I'm like,
goodness.
You've done three in 5 years. And Jack, like, yeah. One deal.
I got journalists who do an article every 6 weeks.
Do you know how many that is? That's an insane number. Operationally, culturally, financially, unless you tell me you're picking up an advisor that has $40 million at LPL, then if that counts, then great, right? But are you really going to be happy with what you end up at the end? Because you're going to have to lower the bar on quality. Because if you start from zero, if you've never done this before, you have no relationships, right? I think this is where the metric changes a little bit. If you're a firm that has been in the game for 10 years and has a lot of relationships, Focus has a lot of relationships. I would argue most of the larger firms, they kind of know the ecosystem and the fabric of firms out there. You can turn the dial however you want. Hey, we're going to be slightly more aggressive, slightly less aggressive. We're going to take on more, maybe slightly more mass affluent, maybe slightly lower growth, maybe slightly bigger, pay a little more. Like we can, you know what dials to turn to do more or less deals, right? Or when you want to be more selective. But when you just started out and you've never done this before, you're going to just participate in every process and try to do everything you can. And that's hard. Right. And I think this is where you get caught. And that's the only way you make these firms not be successful is just to have a patchwork of things that don't hold together. And you find a lot of these CEOs tend to leave after a while. Like if there's a few RAs that take investment from an outside firm or rotate investments, then the entire management team disappears. And that's probably not a good sign on what the vision was for the business.
So I've had a pin in one of your earlier answers that I've been waiting to get to for a little bit. And you kind of talked a little bit about flows. And I feel like the big lie of this industry is that everybody has strong flows. And that's not true.
Everybody.
Most firms have negative flows and they're being kind of propped up by the marketplace, or at least that's kind of the sentiment that I've gotten. What are the traits of firms that actually do have positive flows? And for some of these firms that have been kind of carried by market appreciation, what happens to them and what are the pressures put on them when a downturn does inevitably come?
Right. So I'll start by saying something that will not be popular, which is flows is a metric that only became relevant when we artificially created equity value into this industry. 30 years ago, when you're a wealth management firm in the suburbs of Chicago and you take care of your clients and you do a good job and you get referrals and you get additions and you get withdrawals and you get losses, whatever, you just run your business. And to the point about under management of these businesses, you don't pay attention to your metrics. You don't think about metrics. You just do a good job and good things happen, right? Like the restaurant in the West Village down the block doesn't measure how many dollars per plate, what is my profit margin per seat, and how many seats can I fit in the restaurant, right? They're saying, right, we're going to make an amazing food and charge a lot and it will go well. Pizza Hut probably checks every single metric, right, to make sure the math work at mega scale. So we create that metric as a measure of quality of these businesses, but they never judge themselves by this metric. You know how I know is because 90% of the firms that you meet do not know their own flows. And they cannot measure it, and they are incapable of telling you, number one, what the metrics are, what the submetrics are, and what drives these metrics. When someone has a lot of outflows, first of all, they never think about the outflows. If you meet a CEO of an RIA today, they will only tell you how they're growing like crazy, and they want a whole bunch of $20 million clients. Forget the fact that their average client is 200,000. They only think about the two mega clients they won in the last year, and they never think about losses or attrition or anything like that. But that's a metric that nobody ever really thought about. So only now people are starting to get more aware of it. But even now, most of the firms don't have good data. They don't have the infrastructure to track. You'd be surprised. I mean, ask investment bankers that I'm sure, Ian, you talk to, based on your articles, they spend months trying to get net flows from these RIAs, or arguably that's something you track. I mean, you guys know the viewers for every one of your articles every day, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's pretty straight.
In real time.
Your clicks per whatever. So
down to the individual reader, but yeah.
I believe that, right? We don't have that in this industry. So the big firms have to get better at it. And then arguably, once you know your flows, you can understand who are my clients, right? There's a big BI opportunity in business intelligence opportunity in the wealth management space where our business intelligence is pathetic. For a consumer business to have such weak business intelligence, when I speak to friends of mine who worked at L'Oreal or at Facebook or at any consumer goods business, and they understand their clients down to the color of their glasses. And we're like, well, yeah, they kind of came. We're not quite sure why they're here, but they're kind of here, and we like them. They're good guys. And, you know, that's crazy, right? So I think that's very critical. Your question were, what are the firms that are growing? What are they doing?
Yes.
And again, I lost my McKinsey training, where I would have to come with three answers. I only have two for you today. Let's say that we can come up with three. There's really three ways you would have high growth firms. Number one, which is culture. Do you have usually founders that are driving a culture of growth, right? This is a place where you grow. When I started at Focus, every week there was an M&A pipeline meeting, right? That was our version of growth, obviously, right? But you go around the room and everybody's talking about their pipeline. And if at some point for three meetings in a row, you have nothing to talk about and every founders are around the room, at some point you look a little stupid, right? So do you have founders that are hungry, that are driving the culture, that are bringing a lot of business themselves because they're younger, earlier in their career? That's the best way to grow early on, arguably, right? As you scale, obviously it becomes harder. Number two is, so now you have the culture, are you willing to put in place the infrastructure to grow? And again, I mentioned business intelligence. Do you have the metrics in place? Do you have the dashboards? Do you do training? 99% of firms don't do sales training. Right? Advisors get CFP training, CFA training, all kinds of training in the world. They don't get trained to ask for a referral, to ask for additional business. I use my advisor again, and I love him, and he's the best. When I left my job and I had a fairly nice 401k, he never called me to get my rollover. And he knew I was leaving because we had done the math with him for many months before I quit and wanted to launch this new business. And I don't know if it was a matter of the infrastructure, like his technology should have said, hey, Eric left his job, ping, 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 get the rollover. Or he should have been trained to ask for rollover for every one of his clients every now and then. But clearly that something didn't happen, right? So there's a level of process, infrastructure, training that needs to happen. That's kind of your second layer. And then the third layer is you have to have a channel. For Peter, again, this is an advertising for Peter Maluka, I guess, his whole pod, so good for him. TD reference.
On you, we should say, not on us.
No, fair enough. Because that's what I listened to before I came here, to get a feel for the pod. TD referral programs. Right, for many firms, it's going to be the referral program. We know how to get on these programs, and we need to execute at scale really, really well. For Fisher, it was ads and online ads and whatever. Edelman, it was seminars, right? But like, you have to have one way where you can fill up the top of the funnel. Most RIAs, the mistake they do a little bit of everything. And when you have a $300 million firm, you have to do a lot of everything. When you're a $5 million firm, don't do seminars and lead gen and referral programs and go talk to COIs. It's just, you're going to get lost. Just do one thing and do it really, really well and learn and invest the money and make the mistakes. So to the earlier point about management, this is where management happens. This is where executive bandwidth happens. And some firms and some founders are willing to spend the time and energy to learn this and to figure it out. And by the way, without fault, some founders are like, you know what? We're fine. We're doing a good job. And, you know, we had firms in our at Focus where the CEO, $12 billion firm, would tell us, I'm going to grow 8% every year, like a clock. Whether it's market, organic, whatever, it's going to be 8% every year. That's my metric. My top line will grow 8%. And he did since 07 till 2024. Now his firm disappeared, which is always sad after a 50-year horizon. But that was his metric. And he didn't care about anything else, which we thought was weird, but he managed the business to that, and that worked for him. So there's no fault to anybody. It's just, how much do you want to think through your firm versus having a practice effectively?
So you've mentioned the investment banking community a little bit. And so I'm curious, you know, one, what proportion of deals that you guys negotiated in the early days at Focus involved a banker versus at the end? And I guess what are kind of some of the complications or confounding variables that using a sell side banker might introduce into the process? So what's it like managing those relations with the banking community as a buyer?
Well, when we were early on in Focus, the answer is zero, right? Very few deals were banked. The largest firms were being banked. The smaller ones were just not, right? And there was not many bankers in the space, and there was a few of them that have been around that have been extremely successful and very smart. There's just not that many. And by the way, there were not that many buyers either, right? I mean, it was us and maybe three other shops, right? The ecosystem that has become very big, the number of buyers has become very big. So as a buyer, bankers are your friends because they control a lot of flows, because they're going to show you opportunities and you just need to have them. And as a seller, they are also your friend because, as I mentioned before, sellers are getting 5 phone calls a week. And you get very confused because all these things are very different. Like I know a seller who sent me a text message like, "Eric, I got this offer from a roll-up that I shall not name. I've met him only once and he's texted me a financial offer for my business. And what do I do with this?" And I was like, "Well, he doesn't know who you are, knows nothing about you, just throw up your number. That's insane." So you need someone to kind of guide you through that. So I think it's a positive for the industry. Now, here's where things become complicated is that there are just too many buyers. And what you don't have when you go through a banker, whether you're especially as a buyer, is if you haven't done any kind of outreach, if you have no relationship with any of these firms, you know nothing, right? It's like you see a SIM, which is arguably the best looking presentation you can have about that business that ever exists in the history of mankind, right? It's like you meet someone at a wedding. They are the best possibly dressed you will ever meet them in their lives, right? It only goes down from there. So that's dangerous because, "Oh my God, I love this firm. They're amazing," right? And then you meet them and then you learn more about it. But you don't get that opportunity in a banker process. Some bankers will send a book to 20 buyers. They said, "Give me a number. And based on your number, we're going to wiggle it out to 10. And then we're going to have meetings," which I get from the banker side and from the seller side. You don't want to be overwhelmed with meetings. But as a potential buyer, I'm like, I cannot put a number on a business that I don't know. This is a human capital business. I'm investing in humans first and foremost, right? If this was a factory, that's fine. But I'm investing in humans. So if I invest in humans without knowing the humans, how do I know I'm going to get along with them? How do I know they're going to fit into my culture? How do I know how they think about client service, investments? How do they think about growth? How do they think about fitting in into a bigger organization, right? And so it becomes very dicey. But you have no choice. So you have to play that game. And that's why if you only rely on that with nothing else, it doesn't work. Well, towards the end at Focus, we had more deals that were banked, but we had long, long lasting relationship with most of these sellers. And so when they came to market through a banker, we're like, "Okay, so we know these guys. We spend hours with them and we know we have to pay a little bit more now because it's being banked and not being banked. But there's such a good relationship." So I would say, from a buyer's perspective, you have to win every soft. First of all, you have to know that you like the firm. That means you have to know them. You have to know who they are. Then you have to have won every single soft argument possible, meaning they have to like me. They have to understand their role in my organization. They have to understand how we're going to work together. They have to understand the pros and the cons. And they have to get comfortable with me, right? If they know me, if they've seen me being consistent over the years in what I say I was going to do and my ability to deliver on these things. Then when it comes to financial, I don't believe that sellers in the industry are extremely greedy. I think there's a number they have to hit. But I think that beyond that number, they're going to care about their people. They're going to care about their clients. They're going to care about their own happiness in the broader ecosystem, more so than people believe. So it's knowing people you're going to be in business with effectively matters, is what I'm saying, which is an obviousness type of statement. But that gets lost a little bit in translation, because when you're a 5,000 people organization and you have to do a deal, otherwise someone is going to get yelled at the next monthly operating committee, that gets more dicey. So I would say, you know, bankers understand that. Your job is to work well with the bankers and understand how they work, what they care about, and, you know, what their incentives are. Your job as a buyer is to make sure that also you know your universe. You know who fits, who doesn't fit, and the ones that fit, you have to know who they are, understanding their drivers, spend time with them, commit yourself to doing a lot of work so that when they are ready to transact, you are top of mind and you're ahead of the game. And by the way, I lost deals in the past because they said, "Hey, Eric, I know this guy for 20 years, so I'm going to work with him." And I was like, "Oh, that's fair. You should do that. That makes more sense."
Eric, look, thank you very much indeed. Absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast here.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Ian.
Yes, thanks for coming here.
Yeah, and I think you said at the start of this that people have a lot more authority speaking with a British accent, which I'll take. But I think the French accent works pretty well when discussing RAA, M&A. I think it adds a certain je ne sais quoi.
For sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, look, we will be back again for another episode of This Week in Wealth. But that's it from us this week. Goodbye.